Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 3D printing is everywhere, doing amazing things. Take this report from North Carolina.
In our morning rounds, reaching for the future, a North Carolina college student created prosthetic hands for kids. They cost a lot less than regular models. Here's the amazing part. He did it using a 3D printer.
Prosthetic hands for kids, microscopic surgical tools, precision parts for massive aerospace engines. 3D printing is one of those technologies that's transforming what's possible at both the consumer and industrial level at the very same time. And perhaps you didn't know, but Greater Boston is a critical nexus for the development of 3D technology, in part because it began here.
I think our MIT effort was the first effort in Boston. Now there are a bunch of other technologies within an hour's drive. So this is a real hotbed for digitally driven manufacturing, and that's not widely appreciated.
This is Dr. Emmanuel Sachs, a professor of mechanical engineering at MIT. He first envisioned the concept of 3D printing. He filed the earliest patents on the technology and coined the very term back in the late 1980s. Although, as with any great stride forward, even the name 3D printing almost didn't happen.
So we made a list of a couple dozen names, and I shopped them around. I asked everyone I could, you know, take a look at this. And everybody reacted negatively to three-dimensional printing.
No kidding.
Yeah. And, well, they said, well, it's not printing. And it's, you know, printing is books. And because my father had been a publisher, he used to take me to the printing presses when his books were being published. And so I was very fond of printing. And so I said, I'm doing 3D printing.
So that
was the sum of my market research, exactly not listening to it.
As you can hear, Emmanuel Sachs is a wonderfully warm, brilliant inventor. So where did all that delightful genius come from? That's where we began our conversation when Sachs recently visited our studios.
My parents were both word people. My father was a publisher and my mother was an editor. But I ended up building stuff starting from apparently when I was 4 years old. And I never thought that there was anyone in the family on either side who was an engineer until my 40th birthday. And my dad told me that, in fact, I did have a distant cousin who was an electrical engineer, but he accidentally electrocuted himself.
Oh.
And so my father didn't want to dissuade me from my chosen path.
Well, lessons learned from a family member's experience.
Mm-hmm.
When did you first start thinking about what was, I guess, what, did we even call it 3D printing then?
No, we didn't. So I was in my third year as a junior faculty member at MIT, and I had always built things when I was a kid, and so I understood the difficulty, just how much time and effort it took to build mechanical stuff. And I happened to have a chance to see what's called a beta installation, meaning one of the early installations of stereolithography, which was the first commercial technology in this space. As soon as I saw that, I said, yes, of course. And I started to immediately think about making functional parts and tooling, because stereolithography makes plastic parts.
So stereolithography, describe to me how it worked back then, because were the plastic resins coming out of what, you know, we would recognize as a kind of printer?
No, the way it was done back then, and still is, although there are other forms of it now, is you have a vat of a photopolymer, so this is a liquid resin, and you trace a laser over the surface, and that laser causes that polymer to cross-link and turn into solid. And then you drop the part down, and so the part essentially gets swallowed up by the liquid to create a new layer of liquid, and then you come along with the laser again. And you keep repeating that hundreds or thousands of times. And then when you're done, you pull the part up through the liquid. It's like it's emerging out of the ocean.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. So that's what I saw in a very, very early form.
Well, so let me ask you. I'm always curious, and I know that, you know, science and development of new technologies is a process, but did you have a eureka moment when you said, okay, I'm looking at the stereolithography, and now I can see, well, if we do this, if we make this change, we can suddenly start building these much more complex parts and systems through, as you were talking about, through this additive process. Was it a eureka moment?
In some things that I've done in the past, I have a clear recollection of such a moment. This is not one of those cases.
Okay.
So in this case, I knew I couldn't take the stereolithography process per se.
Yeah.
So what I did was started collaborating with a colleague at MIT, and we came up with a whole list of concepts. We had somewhere like 15 ideas, but what I was looking for was a very specific application that I was quite sure would work, and that's why we chose the one we did. So the others were all very speculative. And, you know, very dreamy, and in some ways you could convince yourself that there was even more magic in them. But I didn't have something tangible
right.
that I could build on. So that's why we chose the process that we did, which was spreading powder and inkjet printing binder. And that is now known in the field as binder jet printing, because I didn't trademark the term three-dimensional printing. And so the field took it and gave us a different name. I like my name, but it's, yeah, that's gone.
It's one of those if onlys, right?
If only. You know, looking back during those 14 years of that project, we thought of so many applications, and we didn't file a single patent application on applications, only on technology. And what a mistake that was. But that's just the way we were oriented, and still the way I am.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, like, we're in a day and an age now where everybody intuitively understands the basics of what 3D printing is and means. It's the perfect name.
Right.
Now when you first, what's the first thing that you actually ever 3D printed?
It sort of looked like a tic-tac-toe board. But in three dimensions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So very simple part.
And what year was this?
Oh, that would have been probably 89.
So that must have been pretty exciting.
It was.
Now, was it obvious to you? I'm imagining the answer is yes, but was it apparent to you from early on after those initial prototypes and the first sort of generation of the technology that you were developing proved successful, that it would have immediately so many potential applications?
Yes and no. We started in our project at MIT, we started to explore lots of different applications. So there were the design applications, there were metal applications in several forms, orthopedic implants, surgical tools, some parts for automotive applications. There's a licensee doing pills. So this is something you pop in your mouth and you get instant drug release. Taking advantage of the porosity that happens during this printing
yeah.
process. There was a time when, in my naivete, and you know, I can say this was a few years ago also, that I thought, oh, everything is going to be made this way. But of course, that's not the case. And that was you know, the moments when I thought that, I suppose even a voice in my head knew otherwise. So. But what's actually been surprising is over the last 5 or 6 years, there's sort of a rebirth of this field.
Yeah, so over the past, you're right, over the past 5 or 6 years, all of a sudden this technology is, forms of the technology is everywhere.
Yes.
Right? I think like a week doesn't go by where I don't hear of, you know, there was a news story about a turtle that received a 3D printed prosthetic flipper, right? I mean, the field of the broader field of human medical science, there's so many 3D printing applications.
That's right.
at the consumer level? They're in schools now? Like,
yes.
Kids are designing their own 3D printed parts?
Yeah, they actually play a very large role in academic environments, starting from grade school and including university. And that part is really a lot of fun because, again, it takes so long to make prototypes any other way,
right,
that this really enables people to make. And to me, that's very exciting.
It makes the process of like you said, experimentation and discovery,
right,
that much more faster, and you get quicker feedback. It makes it more exciting, I
think.
That's
right. That's right.
But what I really wanted to talk with you about are the applications that we lay people may not be seeing in terms of 3D printing, and the applications that drew you to developing this technology to begin with, like the industrial applications,
yes,
right? Because I'm seeing that, for example, this fall, GE Aviation completed tests on a demonstrator engine that had 35% of its parts produced by 3D printing or additive manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, GE has made a huge investment that's almost exclusively of metal parts, which is the really fast growing area right now.
Well, for these large-scale industrial applications, you know, the building a GE engine, GE Aviation, right? So it's either an airplane or aerospace engine,
yes.
I'd gather. I mean, what are the advantages? To me, one of the first advantages, and I'm obviously just a layperson, mm-hmm. but correct me if I'm wrong, is that with 3D printing technology, there's no welds or seams, right?
Yeah.
Like you can craft a whole part.
That's right. That's a very important example of an advantage, is that you can replace an assembly that might have been 80 parts, you can replace with two. It reduces all the joints, and the joints are also failure points.
Right.
So it actually increases the safety. This takes advantage of the fact that you can create these internal geometries. So that's often why you have to make parts out of multiple pieces, is because you can't make that cavity. And so imagine you have fuel running around and hot gases, and you have these crazy shaped chambers and reaction spaces, and you can see why aerospace is a fabulous application for these technologies. Mm-hmm. So you also save weight. Because there are fewer parts, you can make it smaller. You can take weight out of walls by making cellular structures, you know, sort of like trusses, mm-hmm. instead of solid materials.
Yeah.
And so it's all of those things wrapped together. It's actually limited in how fast it's growing. The demand is huge, but the problem is these are industrial scale machines. Mm-hmm. They're large, they're very expensive, and also because of the technologies chosen, they're slow. So that makes the parts very, very expensive.
Well, for the current industrial grade machines, when you say slow, does it take hours, days to make some of these parts?
Yes. So the build rate is 1 cubic inch an hour.
Oh.
Slow.
Very slow.
Very slow.
Do you see that? Are there any limits to what this technology could do, design, build in the future?
So you have to remember that humanity has been making stuff forever, right? So investment casting is 4,000 years old. So if the question is how much of the existing base of manufacturing technologies is going to turn over to 3D printing, the answer to that is more and more over time, but not all. So, you know, the field will continue to grow, and where it ends up, who knows? And I used to try and think about that, but I don't anymore. It's just whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Right now, it's a 30% growth rate annual.
30%?
30%, right.
Yep. 30% in terms of the
compound annual growth of the sale of machines and services. it's very healthy, very healthy. So there were years.
I have a feeling I should have gotten in 5 years ago.
Yeah,
should have given you $10 5 years ago.
But the real leverage of these technologies is how people use them, right? So it's not I think it's about $5 billion of equipment and services that's the direct economic value of 3D printing. It's the impact on the company that's using it to create a better design.
Do you Do you feel proud that you've played such a foundational role in the creation of this technology?
Yeah, sure. I mostly feel lucky. So it's been fun. I've had two main areas in my career, this and solar cells, photovoltaics. And it's hard to get even one of those in a career. And so I've been very lucky to have opportunities and be able to develop them.
Okay, so final, just silly little question. I've enjoyed this conversation so very much, but do people ever come to you and say, hey, I had this idea for something to build. Can you just make it for me? You know, since you're creating all these technologies, you have family members who say, I need a part. Can you make it for me?
Uh-huh. Well, my wife and I have two kids, both sons, and they're both engineers, and they use 3D printing all the time. So they don't have to come. In fact, the younger one, who's in his junior year at Cornell right now, when he and a friend built a 3D printer as a high school project, and they made some nice little parts. And so he comes home and he says, Dad, what was so hard about this?
you're asking that question now. You should have asked me 30 years ago.
Right.
Well, Dr. Sachs, thank you so very much. It's been such a delight to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Emmanuel Sachs is a professor of mechanical engineering at MIT and one of the founding inventors of 3D printing technology. By the way, he also mentioned photovoltaics. Turns out he invented a way to grow crystals that makes it possible to manufacture photovoltaic cells more cheaply and efficiently than had previously been known to do before. So, yeah, he knows his stuff. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.